Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So one of the issues that's really an ongoing challenge in our democracy is how to attract younger people into the political process, not simply through elections and voter mobilization, which we often talk about, but also in the ways younger Americans learn about politics, interpret politics, analyze politics. The two of us spend a lot of time in different ways doing that, certainly a focus of my courses. And we need to kind of think of ways to make politics as interesting and as attractive as the fictionalized characters on the popular television shows and films that are out there. And it's hard. Many adults find politics something difficult to digest and often unappealing. But I think it's something that we can't move away from. So today we have with us Gabe Fleischer, the editor of Wake Up to Politics, which has received considerable attention over the last few weeks. This is a newsletter that's distributed pretty widely and has caught the attention of the New York Times, CNN, and more. What's striking is the author, Gabe, is 15 years old and does this out of his room, but is now producing something that's read by all kinds and all ages of Americans, including some very prominent journalists who are on his list. So we are really delighted to have Gabe on the show. Welcome, Gabe.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So this kind of an incredible story. You are currently, you just finished ninth grade. And how long have you been writing this news report for?
Yeah, I first started writing the newsletter in 2011 when I was 9 years old, just as a daily email to my mom. I've really been fascinated by politics since the 2008 elections, and I'd always be reading about politics and talking about politics, and she said, just put in an email, just get into an email. And so I started writing her this email, and then she sent it to my grandparents and friends of ours, and it kind of grew and grew from there, and now I have over 36,000 subscribers.
And what was it about the election of 2008 that stimulated your interest in doing this or compelled you to start telling your mom, I have all these ideas I want to get out there somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really, I think during any election time, I think we saw it during this most recent election, you know, there's TV ads, there's bumper stickers, there's yard signs. I think elections are kind of all around us. And I don't know exactly what sparked that curiosity in me, but I really just started asking my parents questions. Then I started getting books, you know, from our library about politics, and something about it really just sparked my interest.
Like, what are some books that you got that interested you?
Yeah, so actually one of the first books for that I read about politics was actually True Compass, Ted Kennedy's memoir. It's a big book, but it was, I think it had just come out, I think, at that time period, and that was one of the first books that I read. There's a book for younger people that I read early on called See How They Run, which I still have, which is a really good book for kids. And I really just started from there, just all kinds of books about really first history more, and then about current events and politics.
Wait, you read True Compass when you were nine?
I think, yeah.
That book is kind of a brick. Like,
it's a big book. I've read it again since then. I don't know how much of it I've always really loved to read, and I think it had just come out. It was one of the first books that I read.
And so you're first doing this for friends, for family, right? Mm-hmm. For your mom. And what do you do? Are you just kind of jotting down ideas and sending it to them, or do you start to do it in a more polished structure?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly improved since I was nine, but it's always had the same kind of idea, which is, you know, to give a pretty comprehensive, I hope, you know, summary of what is it. It's all, you know, Wake Up to Politics, so it's sent in the morning, what's going on in the day, and then also what happened since I sent out the last newsletter. And, you know, I try to make it really accessible to all kinds of people, you know, so I have a lot of students who are subscribed. I have teachers who read it with their classrooms, but I also have, you know, mostly adults, and I have a lot of people in Washington who read it. So I just try to make things accessible and explain things, but not dumb it down. So I do try to cover as much as possible.
So I'm looking at this, and your followers are all kinds of people. It's just like regular, you know, sports fans, newspaper people, communication strategists. I'm just looking at your Twitter followers. And it looks like you do have a pretty wide variety of readers. So I'm just curious, like, did you start writing it in order to write to yourself? I mean, who's your audience? Yourself? Your mom?
Originally?
Is it just trying to make sense of what's going on out there?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think in some ways, I mean, I like to think it's kind of like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I only had 2,000 subscribers, which was still, you know, to me, quite a big amount, but obviously now it's a lot bigger. But I'm just trying to do the same thing. I guess, you know, trying to make sense of what's going on. I think there's so much information coming at people now. Not all of it's correct, and not all of it is necessarily, and so just trying to separate what's important and what isn't, and trying to give people really just facts and not put my own personal bias as much as possible into it. So, and really just give people a starting base of what's going on, so they can then form their own opinions.
Well, given the level of polarization that's gripped politics in the last few decades, how do you select what you read? Because there's such a wide range of stuff that's available. Like, how does one even achieve non-biased synthesis of news?
Yeah, it's not easy. And a big part of that, like on Twitter, I follow, you know, mostly journalists. I follow commentators from both sides, from no side. I read every morning. It's just about where you go to read. And so I try to go to sources that I think are non-biased, or be conscious of the bias of the sources that I read, and try to go to places from both sides of the aisle. And, you know, it's not always easy, but I think, you know, it's important to have a starting base of facts. And I think in this country, we've maybe started to travel away from that in a lot of sources. And so it's very important. It's not always easy, but I think it's really important to try as hard as I can.
So now wait a second, because, we both have kids, so we know where you are age-wise. When does it come out? So you start writing it when? I mean, what time do you wake up to write this?
Yeah, so I wake up. Well, really, I start it, you know, when I get home from school. I'm kind of immediately on Twitter, and inevitably now there's like 5 things that I've missed that have gone on since I was gone. And I kind of gather all the sources that I want to have. And then by the time I go to sleep, I kind of have an idea of what I want to write about. And I wake up just before 6 o'clock and I send it out. And by 7:40, I have to be out the door to go to school.
And what are the sources? Like, what are you looking at?
So, yeah, every morning Politico, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Associated Press. Those are kind of the core sources that I rely on.
And is Mike, did you read Mike Allen's playbook? Was that an inspiration for this style or any other of those, you know?
Yeah, I do read. I don't always read them in the morning, but I'm subscribed to Playbook, you know, his new newsletter at Axios, the Daily 202 from Washington Post. I will say I think Playbook was definitely an inspiration, but again, I do think I write for kind of a different audience, not as many, you know, insiders in DC trying to a more emphasis on explaining things. But it certainly was an inspiration of the format.
So if you want to explain something like, I don't know, let's pick something where if somebody's really an insider and they've been following a story for a while, in the Affordable Care Act, there's cost sharing reduction payments. If you come into that story midway through, I don't know, a typical reader is going to say, cost sharing, why are we even hearing about this? What is going on here? And so how do you frame bringing people into a subject like that where, like, what the heck is going on with, you know, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare exchanges? Like, do you rewind and, like, get people up to speed?
So the first step in that is, you know, me making sure I understand it. And so, you know, topics like, you know, healthcare, tax reform, those are always things that I'm most comfortable, you know, talking about. So I spend a lot of time researching. You know, I read all kinds of books and research from all different types of sites to make sure I'm comfortable talking about an issue. And then another thing that I do that I think is also kind of unique in the newsletter is I have a big focus on, like, each day what the president is doing and what Congress is doing. And I think that gives me a good entry point when you talk about something like repealing Obamacare, which is obviously like a months-long process, to each day give an update, or not each day, but, you know, a few times a week maybe give an update. This is what's happening in the legislative process today. And then hoping that people, if they read every day, you have a sense of, you know, yesterday you read about the markup in the committee, so today, you know, we're out of the committee. And so that kind of makes sense, that kind of logical process, where I think a lot of sources don't always focus on that. But I definitely, I try each day what's happening what our leaders are doing each day. So that's one of the ways that I try to help with that.
And you want to make this nonpartisan and put out the facts. And that is something many journalists struggle with. How do you actually do that? Not simply because the media, there's so many media outlets where you'll get information that's biased or it's social media, but it's just hard, especially in an era like this where people have strong opinions about everything, to just literally give nonpartisan information. So what do you mean by that, and how do you try to achieve that?
So when I say nonpartisan, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm the only one who writes it, so whatever I put in there, that's my decision, and I'm very conscious that, you know, my biases would go into how what I decide to write about it, or how I decide to write about it. But I just try to focus, and at the whole time that I'm writing it, I'm really, you know, aware of making sure I'm just putting facts, and if I'm wording something and I think that's a little too biased one way or the other, I try to fix that. And I really, you know, I just try to always be aware of how I'm writing it. And I also hear all the time from people that's something that a lot of people are looking for now, because as you say, a lot of the media has become really partisan. And so I'm just always aware that's, I think, part of the value of the newsletter that I write. And so then if I'm just injecting my own opinion, I think it loses a lot of the value and the uniqueness.
If I think about my own media consumption habits, I'm not even sure that I have that much of a problem with people being partisan, because partisanship has been a part of at least opinion commentary. There's other things that seem to come into this, like picking what story to follow. Like, for instance, if you look at, say, what the cable networks use to follow, like in the Comey hearings, right, in James Comey's testimony before Congress, most organizations chose his testimony as the thing to cover, but Fox News chose something else entirely. They went with something else for a while. And so there's story choice, and that's one aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit.
So I think story choice is part of it. I think also, like, that idea of sensationalizing is part of it too, where, you know, I have to go to school eventually, so I can't cover everything, so it is difficult sometimes. If you take something like the Comey hearing, I certainly look at that, and I think that's something that's very important for my readers to know about, so I include that. You know, and I don't think – when I talk about nonpartisanship, I don't necessarily mean equal balance. So if I do one story about the Comey hearing, I don't feel compelled to do one story that, you know, the White House might want to be in there. I don't look at it from that angle, but just – I try not to sensationalize and try not to focus on things that are most, you know, salacious. I don't try to focus on, you know, necessarily the palace intrigue of what's going on. Right. Just things that affect people. So I think anything you talk about, you know, healthcare, tax reform, things that affect people, things that are important when people go to make sure they're informed voters. And another part I will say also of how I try to do that is, you know, when I'm in school, you know, I talk about politics a lot, or I'm dragged into conversations a lot about politics. But that is something that nonpartisanship is something I remain, you know, all the time. And so that helps me too, where so I'm not all the time thinking about my opinion and saying my opinion makes it easier, so that in the newsletter I don't betray that.
Well, people who are really knowledgeable about politics, especially media figures, will often get into who's up and who's down and kind of horse raciness. And so there's often a lot of excitement about the interpersonal conflicts. And I think you used the phrase palace intrigue. So are you able to maintain a focus on, say, I don't know, how many million people will be affected by Obamacare repeal, or what it means to for the Russians to be involved in the election? How does one separate the interpersonal from the substantive, or do you?
I mean, it's not always easy. I try to. I don't know if I always succeed at that. I really, like, I think it's important. It's not like to open Twitter and then to just write a story about everything that I see. I don't see the value in that. So I do think really deeply, you know, during the whole process of writing about what to focus on. Some days, if there is something going on in the White House, you know, on the personnel level, sometimes I do think that's important. And sometimes I do think it's important for people to know if it's really chaotic. I do think it's important. But it's always just going through the focus of what people would need to know when they go to vote. And because my whole focus is making people make sure people are more informed voters and trying to go from that angle.
And is it hard? So you now, because of the attention, there was a New York Times article about you and CNN. I was in the studio watching you being interviewed right before I went on. And one of the challenges isn't simply game change versus, you know, bigger structural issues, but it's more boring parts of politics versus the splashier parts. And this is an ongoing challenge. So when you write a newsletter like this, you want people to read it. You want it to get attention. Is it hard to, like, say, I'm going to write a paragraph or something on, you know, the details of what's going on in Medicaid that actually matter, or some kinds of policy issues that are harder to get people interested in? So I guess I'm asking, do you cover that, and how do you cover that in ways that a younger person your age would actually want to read it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think part of it is not – well, again, I would say a big part of how I do that is that kind of each day the focus on what's going on in Washington. I think that's a really good way to go about it. So, you know, if one day I'm writing about the confirmation vote for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, you know, then that's what I'm going to write about. And I'm going to explain who that person is, what that position means. And or if it's a vote like the other day, the vote on VA accountability, you know, what that bill is. Give people context is so important, you know, what that scandal, what how that scandal manifested itself and over the past few years, and giving people that context. And so, you know, not everything's going to be, you know, fascinating for everyone, but, you know, and sometimes people write me and say, I don't really care about that thing or another, but I mean, I'm just writing it. You know, I'm not making money off this. I'm not, you know, I have, you know, a pretty large audience, and I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And really, it's just a lot of fun for me to just write. So, you know, if there's things that people aren't as interested in, you know, I think it's just, I hope that they still read it and try to learn more. And then also a lot of times people ask me questions. And so that's, I always try to answer people's questions whenever they come to me. If I didn't do as good a job explaining something, trying to make sure they understand what's going on.
What do you think right now? There's some obvious answers, but what are, you know, two of the most important issues out there that we need to be following, and that you want your readers to be paying attention to?
Well, certainly, I mean, I think right now, this week, I think, you know, healthcare, the continuing negotiations over healthcare, probably the single most important.
I'm gesturing at him that, yes, this is exactly the number one topic that affects people's lives. Keep on going. I'm sorry.
I think you're exactly
Sam was cheering on yes. the answer.
The topic that's affecting people most right now and how those negotiations are being run, you know, very much behind closed doors and in secret. And these are, you know, and I've been talking about for weeks about the CBO report that's come out, and, you know, tens of millions of people who will be affected by this. So I think that's certainly the number one issue that is happening, you know, really this week and right now. That's important.
So I'm interested in that. So that's the number one story. I think I agree with you about that. And it's hard to keep track of that, because whether Sessions answers questions honestly or whether Senator Kamala Harris gets shouted down by some, like, white dude senator, like that, those seem exciting. But here you've put your finger on a thing that's happening in the dark without disclosure. And that doesn't make for good television at all. It doesn't capture people's attention. I'm noticing on my news feeds, people are not talking about that dark process. So how does one make that interesting?
I mean, I think partly by not trying to make it interesting. Like, I don't try to sensationalize things. Like, if I think I just write the facts, and I write what's going on, and I think people understand, because my newsletter is fairly short, and I think people understand, you know, I hope that if I put it in the newsletter, then in my opinion, it is interesting or it is important, and then people can take with that what they will, and I hope that people will see that and then be involved no matter what their opinion is of what's going on. So, but I don't think, you know, psyching things up and saying this is the most important thing that's happened in a decade, or this is the biggest hearing that we've seen, you know, since Watergate. I don't think that helps people, because if we say that every week, then there's no context for what's actually important. So if I put it in there, I think it's important, and then I hope people think so too.
Well, my counterargument to that is that you're right that it is kind of funny to keep saying it's the biggest thing since Watergate, and we haven't seen something like this in decades. But the counterargument to that is that those statements are also true, right? You've read widely, and you've just let me think here. So, for instance, the passage of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, happened, and presumably this is something you remember since you were following it back then, but the legislative process itself has changed over time. You've read True Compass, and that's a period of Ted Kennedy's career that focuses really on the mid-90s. I was actually on Ted Kennedy's staff, on his committee staff, working on higher ed and research policy at the time. And so I took a year off from science to go work on Capitol Hill for a year. And even in that time, the process has changed. So how does one – I'm just pondering this. So you presumably are aware of how much things have changed in the last 20 years. Do you perceive that people can tell? You see what I'm getting at? Like, I see your point about stories being important, but people, I think, need a little perspective about how unusual the last few decades have been.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that one of the bigger examples of this that I've covered recently would be the nuclear option and the filibuster. And watching that, you know, I covered it in 2013 when Harry Reid and the Democrats, you know, took it away for Supreme Court nominee or for all nominees except for the Supreme Court. And then just recently, as it was extended to the Supreme Court, and now the potential of it being extended to all legislation. And so I think that's one of those things where, I mean, that's such a clear impact on the legislative process and kind of breaking with precedent. And also the hypocrisy that you see on both sides, people on all sides of that issue. And so I think I covered that by trying to draw back the curtain. And I'm a big lover of history, so, you know, giving historical context. And maybe people don't know about the filibuster. So as you said, sometimes it might be difficult for people to understand the gravity of that. But explaining this is what the filibuster is, this is how it's manifest, how it's been implemented since, you know, 1917 or since it's been around, and, you know, tracking the different changes. So it isn't always easy if people don't understand those terms. So that's a big part of it for me, is just explaining what everything is. And so that, you know, anyone who reads my newsletter could be, you know, in elementary school or could be in the halls of Congress. Another book that I've read is, you know, Tip and the Gipper by Chris Matthews. You know, a lot of books like that, you know, about a different time in Washington. And it's so evident every day that times are changing, and that the era where, you know, after 5 o'clock, two leaders from different parties could sit down together and hash out an issue. I mean, clearly that time has passed, and that makes a big difference.
And are most of your readers, I mean, I assume you know a little bit about them, are they still primarily younger people, or now has it changed? Are there as many adults reading? I don't know if you can even tell this, your newsletter as people in high school, et cetera.
I don't know for sure. I think it certainly is. The vast majority are adults, actually. Uh-huh. And I think it's more and more. There was an article about the newsletter in Time for Kids, which was cool for me because that was something that I read when I was in elementary school. And so I think that has kind of – I've gotten a lot of letters since then from teachers who say they've integrated the newsletter into curriculums, and from students who say they've subscribed since then. So I think it's become a little – some more students, but I think it is still mostly adults.
And why do you think this has taken off? So – lots of people try different things like this, and usually you'll end up writing a newsletter for your mother, and it ends there. But this is now has a readership, and again, as I said, it's been featured in the mainstream press. What do you think accounts for the success and the appeal of what you're doing?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's because I've had kind of one mission, and I've kept on it ever since I started, and that's been to explain things and to make things understandable and accessible. And I think especially why it's gotten so much attention now is because we are in an era where, you know, there are so many different sites now for people to go to. And I think people are really overwhelmed, and people are confused about what's going on. And I think people really see the value in one newsletter that kind of tries to filter out what's important and what's true, and take from all different kinds of sources to try to compile, you know, the most important things that are being reported from all over the internet. And also, again, from that nonpartisan perspective of just giving people facts and context.
How did the New York Times pick up on the newsletter?
Yeah, so the reporter, Stuart Emmerich, he told me he was at a wedding.
Yeah.
And a friend of his, or he was talking to someone who was from St. Louis, who I don't know, but who was a subscriber to the newsletter, and they were talking, I think, about youth engagement in politics and said, have you heard of this newsletter by this 15-year-old? And then he subscribed and then he emailed me and he came out here. And so that was a really cool experience.
And how were you surprised? Because after that, the thing kind of exploded. What was your response as you all of a sudden were in the middle of this media frenzy?
Yeah, so the article went online on Friday and then was in print on Sunday. And then on Monday, I had my first final. And then that was my finals week.
That's really funny.
That was kind of difficult. I'm not going to lie. That whole week, I was getting requests all kind of media from all kind of media and try to sort through that and still trying to do well in school. So it's still been overwhelming. And I still haven't gotten through all the emails and everything.
I can tell you that having a day job as a professor and having a breaking news story that's happening at the same time as that is trying. It's probably a good time for developing skills and workflow. So let's see. So in the New York Times piece, it says that you broke through. You were able to get press credentials for two early primary debates in Iowa. How'd you do that?
Yeah. So I've always, obviously, whenever politicians come to St. Louis or nearby, I'm always trying to get in. And I kind of decided really early on that since Iowa is only a few hours drive away from, now I don't have my license yet, but it's only a few hours drive from St. Louis, I really wanted to be there while the caucus process was going on. And so I first emailed the DNC and just explained who I was and said, I really appreciate being credentialed. I'm really nearby. I'm a young journalist. And they wrote back and they gave me credentials and I got to go there. And then when I was there, I met then RNC communications director, Sean Spicer. And
Spicer was there. And so you asked Spicy for credentials.
At the Democratic debate in Des Moines, he was there and I started talking to him and he said, well, if you want to see a real debate, you should come to the Republican one in Iowa. Uh-huh. And then he gave me his business card and then so the Democratic debate was in November and the Republican debate was going to be just a few days before the caucuses. So I emailed him and I said, I'd like to take you up on that. And he was the one who got me credentials to the Republican debate.
What comes next? So you have this, you have a format that you like. I don't know if you even want to continue with this. I assume you do, but you're obviously at an age where you're figuring out exactly your interest. But assuming you want to continue writing this for the near future, do you have plans on new things you'd like to do or new ways in which you'd like to expand your audience? What are you thinking about this newsletter?
Yeah, I mean, right now I'm really kind of focused on continuing to do the newsletter, do it as best as I can and balance it with school and kind of growing it as much as I can. It's certainly something I'd like to continue. I have thought about, different ways maybe that I could, maybe a podcast or YouTube, some way that I could continue with it. But I think with school, it is kind of hard to imagine adding on another way. So this has kind of been a nice middle ground that I've been able to have. And so right now I'm just focused on building it and making it even better every day.
Well, at some level, the simplicity of it, right? Summarizing things and picking out what's important. I mean, getting too complicated and getting too fancy could possibly dilute the thing you're doing. So I could imagine that. I'm curious about something. So one thing I've noticed here, since you're in a demographic, look, you're in an age range we haven't interviewed before, so it comes to mind. In last week's British election, I don't know if you followed that, but if you look at the crosstabs on that, if you look at the age breakdown, there is a huge age divide between 18 and 24-year-old voters in the UK and over 65. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering here, I just want to bring this into the conversation. Over 65s in the UK election voted by a margin of 30 points for the Conservatives, the Tories. 18 to 24-year-olds voted by a margin of 50 points for Labour, right? For the more liberal party, for Jeremy Corbyn, who thinks there should be free college and expanded access to health care. I mean, this is a massive generational divide in politics. When you talk to your friends about politics, what do they care about? Like, do they, what kinds of stuff appeal to them? Do they care about Ivanka? Do they care about health care? Do they care about, Trump's cabinet? What's on their minds?
Yeah, so I do think there is a divide there, and I think there's issues that really clearly impact young people, and that we're really focused on right now. One of them that I see a lot, I think, is the environment and climate change. I think is an issue that I don't know if it gets as much focus nationally, but I think young people are very focused on that and interested in that and engaged in that issue, and you know, education, obviously. Right. And so well, I do think
there's a few factors there, right? Like in the case of climate change, if you're naive and coming into it, it sounds like it's important because the whole planet right. is changing. Plus, you have to live with it longer than I do.
Right.
Right. Exactly. And that's one of the issues, too. You know, it's interesting. I think things have an impact, you know, like in school, you know, teachers at my school, at least, you know, that's one of the few probably current events issues that comes up a lot in classrooms, just, you know, whether, you know, in science class, you know, that's kind of something that has to be discussed and that's talked about. And right, it affects – so issues that are going to affect my generation but maybe not the ones before us, I think are clearly – you know, and I think, like, interestingly, like, there's issues like – you might not think about, like, the national debt that I do think people – young people you might not think are thinking about, but issues like that are going to affect us a lot more as we get older. You know, student loans, obviously, like you said, you know, community college and universities, obviously issues that young people are aware of. And
I wonder how much of this is I wonder how much of this is knowing too much. If you follow politics for decades, I mean, look, I got interested in politics. For me, Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993 mm-hmm. was a moment for me that was very important because it made me aware of the possibility that a young adult could become involved in politics. And so for me at that time, I was 26 at the time, and then I went to work on Capitol Hill. And so I just think about the things that were important to me at the time were possibly different from what's important to me now. I'm just wondering whether maybe people who are like 40, 50 years old have been watching politics for too long. And I don't know, not that they have bad taste, but it's just that there are a lot of things that become important. I don't know, mortgage deductions become important. Like, there's just layers and layers of stuff that are important. And at some level, there are these primal issues. Is the planet changing?
Right. Right. Yeah, I think that's certainly something on there. And then also what you see is people who are around Washington a very long time. I think young people, I think not only do you see a divide in who young people vote for, but obviously there's an issue of whether young people are voting at all and whether right. young people are engaged. And I certainly see young people are very engaged in politics, but not always are very interested in following politics very closely, especially since this most recent election, but maybe not always taking it to that next level. And I do think a big part of that is that same kind of, you know, symptom of people who are around Washington too long and the kind of are becoming even more divided. And I think young people are very frustrated with that and very, you know, ready to bring kind of fresh attitude to government.
I'm just interested in this because, you know, like this whole business, like the thing that really struck me about last week's UK election, as I was saying before, is that the age divide was massive. And the interesting thing about Jeremy Corbyn, did you follow that?
Not as much, no.
Corbyn was promising, he was promising a return to free university, which, you know, is achievable in the UK because higher education is already heavily subsidized there. So he promised that. He promised basically increasing taxes on the rich in order to reinforce healthcare. He's been really unapologetic about just talking about issues that matter in his mind. And people made fun of him for being this unreconstructed socialist, where he's basically a throwback to the 60s. And so the Labour Party's been trying to get rid of the guy, or at least there are forces in the Labour Party who've been trying to get rid of him. But he's sort of like Bernie Sanders on steroids. I mean, he's just like, he is not messing around. And he just says all these socialist things. And that's why I was going off before about the age divide between Labour voters and Conservative voters, where, no joke, an 80-point divide between 18 to 24-year-olds and over 65s. And it's really what I was getting at when I was asking you about your friends, you know, and their interests. And you started talking about climate change and the environment. And it just made me realize that there is something that Corbyn touched among younger voters that apparently no one else had gotten to in UK politics.
I didn't follow that race as closely, but I think, like, certainly this is completely anecdotal, but I will say I went to during the primaries this year, I was credentialed to go to a Sanders event in St. Charles, Missouri, and also I went to a Hillary Clinton event in the St. Louis area. And, you know, the enthusiasm gap that everyone talks about, I mean, is so completely evident. And, you know, Sanders filled a huge arena with mostly young people. And he kind of spoke, to me, it seemed, without very many notes. And he kind of went off, you know, signs that people had in the crowds and kind of, you know, catered to what the young people there were kind of hoping to hear. And Hillary Clinton gave a very, you know, structured speech. And there was It was mostly older people, not very many people there, not many people as enthusiastic. And so I think young people are ready to be very enthusiastic about politics and very engaged, but I think are very naturally skeptical of adults and naturally skeptical if people can tell if people are just reading off of a teleprompter and just talking about issues that they don't really care about. I think young people can tell that really instantly.
But let me push back on that a little bit. I mean, okay, so maybe there was less enthusiasm at the Hillary Clinton event. Maybe she was reading from a speech. But which of those two do you think is more qualified to just get into the nuts and bolts of being president and, I don't know, avoiding a trade or a hot war? You see what I'm saying? So there's this other level.
I'm not on how I feel who is more qualified to be president. I mean, that's not for me to decide. But I think that's right. And I think maybe that's something that blinds people sometimes if you're just hearing, you know, rhetoric that you like and maybe not thinking as deeply about who the more substantive candidate is. But I meant more just by that. I think there's a tendency to think that young people don't vote or are not involved, when in fact I see the opposite in my conversations, that young people are very ready to get involved. But A, they don't always know how. And B, I think they know who they would want to back. They can just kind of tell who's authentic and who's not and who's talking about the issues that matter to them and who isn't, and are following politics very closely. You know, maybe not writing a newsletter about it, but I think young people are really, you know, dedicated to figuring out about issues that affect them and who is going to make changes about those issues.
Well, in American public life, who is there? So Sanders is getting kind of old, and like it's not so obvious that it's a good idea for him to be running for national office in a few years. Who do you see? I'm just saying, just like purely from a demographic point of view, like it's just, you know,
That's true. I don't know if it matters as much, you know, seeing a 40-year-old versus a 70-year-old. I don't know there was an article in the New York Times about that just yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, saying that Sanders, that a lot of his supporters don't care if he's old. I mean, you know, okay. Donald Trump's
right.
not.
Okay, so to you, we're all elderly. Okay, so here we are. Okay, fine. Okay, so we're all elderly. Everyone over 30, we're all old. That's cool. So, okay, so let's include Sanders, but let's just expand the universe a little bit. Who else in public life speaks in a way that sounds like, sounds like he or she is paying attention, sounds like he's saying something that reaches somebody, you know, now that we've gotten you calibrated as somebody who is listening for that?
Like the name, I'm not sure. Well, like I will say, here in Missouri, I think someone, I don't know, Jason Kander.
Yeah.
He kind of clearly broke through as someone who I think was speaking very authentically and was speaking to young people. And I actually met him. I introduced him at an event, a nonpartisan event about young people getting involved in politics. So I think he was someone that I got to hear from. That was certainly speaking that kind of language.
Mm-hmm. Kander made a splash for people who are really following politics. What about, I mean, in the photo of you in the paper, there's also a Jay Nixon sticker. He's not really attracted national attention. Does he speak to you at all?
Not
the same way?
Not the same way. I don't think it's the same way. Although Eric Greitens, I have heard many times, you know, who was just elected as governor, Missouri, Nixon's successor. And he's also a very young face and he with kind of less political experience. So again, I think you see young people sometimes turning to people with who might be closer in age to them or not, but who maybe don't have this as much experience as maybe older voters look for. So he was also someone I heard him speak a few times.
Okay. So let's list a few more. I'm just going to list a few names, and you pick somebody, and we'll finish up pretty soon. But I just want to pick up. I'm just curious. Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris. Any of these people do it for you?
I think of that list, I think Cory Booker probably would be the one that stands out the most in terms of I follow him. I follow all of them on social media. I see him a lot engaging with people, you know, on Twitter, you know, of all kinds of ages, and I think that the way he talks might be a little bit, you know, more attractive to young people. But I think those are all names that I'm sure will be rising stars. And
let me ask you this. So you're very talented, and say all of a sudden you get a call from your friend, Sean Spicer, and says, we're going to give you 10 minutes in the room with President Trump, and you could 15 minutes in the room to ask some questions. What would be one question you'd really want to ask him?
Well, that was a question I was asked that on CNN, and the question that I talked about then was about the president's rhetoric and about how he views that, you know, trickling down to young people, and whether he thinks he views the presidency as kind of a model for young people. So I do think that would be important. But if I were to get 15 minutes, I would hope that I'd focus on issues like we've been talking about that are really going to viscerally affect my generation and what he plans to do about those, you know, environment, student loans, healthcare issues that are going to have the most impact for people. I think certainly I'd have to think more and longer if you were to call, but I'd be ready to do it.
Do you think journalism's going to do well? Some people say we have a crisis of journalism. It's kind of broken, but here you are and you're participating in it and you're not even, I guess you are a journalist at some level, but you're in high school and you're figuring it out. I mean, are you optimistic, not about politics, but about journalism and the potential for doing good journalistic work?
I'm very optimistic because I think maybe journalism in some ways is facing a crisis, but more than that, I think it's really in some ways a golden age of journalism. And I think this administration has really raised some core questions for journalists to answer. And I've been very heartened and optimistic by what I've seen as a response from outlets that are staying tough and asking questions and really reverting back to the model that I've always thought was so important of just giving facts and trying to be as unopinionated as possible, but staying fair and demanding truth and demanding facts and fact-checking people. I'm very optimistic about journalism as an industry remaining an important part of American discourse and demanding, answers from leaders.
And are you going to, this summer, do you stop writing it? Don't you?
I actually, on Saturday, I go to camp for 8 weeks in Minnesota, and no internet, no politics, I guess, so that's it.
Is this going to be okay?
So, it's difficult sometimes. Last summer I was gone during the conventions because they pushed back so early. Yeah. So that was difficult, not knowing who.
Wait, so you missed the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so that was a challenge. Okay. But I love camp, and it's nice, I think, to unplug, but I'm always very, wondering what could be going on, what could be missing, especially now. I imagine I'll be missing, a lot.
Well, you can't even turn your back for a few hours on some days. Yeah. So I'm looking at the photo of you in the Times, and you've got a lot of paraphernalia here on the shelf. You've got figurines, you've got photographs, you've got books, and I'm zooming in on it. It looks like you like presidents. So talk about so that's sort of the great actor model of history where there's individuals who really make a difference, because I'm not seeing a whole lot of congressional leaders on your shelf here. So talk about some of your favorite American politicians. I've got some guesses based on what I'm seeing on the shelf here.
I think presidents have always been kind of really first. I was very fascinated by presidential history. I think a lot of the presidents that I do read a lot about are, the more kind of the great presidents, I've read a lot about Lincoln, about FDR, but also about all kinds of, I've read, I don't know if you've read Destiny of the Republic. I'm looking at it right here, is why it comes to my mind, about James Garfield and about, the book about Coolidge. I try to read about all the presidents, and that's always been something special to me. I've been to now all but two of the presidential libraries too, which
you have
fun to visit.
Yeah, those are places that I really love to go to and visit and to learn more about the presidents. I've only not gone to Nixon and Reagan in California, but hoping to get there sometime. Yeah. And
I'm not seeing a whole lot of Lyndon Johnson on yourself. I see Taft. I see both Roosevelts. I see Lincoln.
I've read one of the Caro books, Master of the Senate.
Oh, that's an amazing book.
Yeah. I'm a big lover of that kind of process, stuff and about, arm twisting that I really loved reading that.
He's looking at his room.
That's all right. Yeah. He's looking at his shelves.
It's all right.
Now.
We're not putting it at a spot.
No, that's fine. I'm just curious about your reading.
There's another book that I read actually. It was by the director of the James Johnson Library. I think it's just called LBJ, but it's all oral.
Right.
It's all audio recordings of Johnson, but organized by that. That was an interesting book.
I think the Johnson era is just so important for understanding
I'll send you a Zelizer Lyndon Johnson book. I wrote a book on it, so I'm fascinated by him as well.
I love.
Okay, well, this has been a terrific interview, and I think both of us hope you continue after camp, keep up the writing. I do think, even though a lot of your readers seem to be adults, I think we both agree on this end that there is a huge space out there for this kind of quality writing for younger people of your age. And if you can fill that void, I think it's a huge contribution and hopefully inspire others to do the same. So that wraps up our episode. And thanks again to Gabe Fleischer, the editor and author of Wake Up to Politics. Both Sam and I urge everyone to subscribe as soon as possible. And thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Thanks for coming on with us, Gabe.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.